Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 137, recorded January 27th, 2014. Hatching Twitter. Triangulation is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get some of the most interesting people on the internet to talk about themselves, their ideas, their lives, or in the case of our guest today, Twitter. Nick Bilton is here. He writes for the New York Times. His previous book was I Live in the Future. Or what was it? Hi, Nick.
Hi. How are you?
I come from, what was it called? I Come from the Future and Everything's Fine Here.
It's something along those lines. It was I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works.
His newest, Hatching Twitter, came out perfect timing the day before Twitter's IPO.
That's correct.
And I don't know if that was planned, but it was brilliant. You see him all the time on This Week in Tech and others of our shows, but we're always glad to have Nick on. He's talking to us from his offices at the New York Times in San Francisco. That San Francisco bureau's burgeoning.
It is. It's growing. All of the bureaus are growing. Wall Street Journal's bureau is growing. Recode. Everyone. It's bubble 2.0, I think.
In journalism, who'd have thunk that?
In journalism, you know, what was it like 2 years ago? We were talking about the death of journalism, and now it's just growing exponentially, and I think it will continue to.
This is completely off topic. We'll get to your book in a second, but to what do you credit that?
You know, I think that we're at a point in time where the distribution has changed. You know, back in the 2000s, we didn't have mobile phones that we could read content on. We didn't have apps where we could save things for later. We didn't have social media where we could share the things that we were reading. And today we do. And I think that there's a larger and larger appetite for really great content. And I think that that's why all of these sites continue to grow and add new people. And there's kind of something for everyone. There's the people that want the very pithy, you know, newsy updates. And then there's the people on the other end that want, you know, the columns that explain what's going on and the in-depth reporting and so on. And so that's, I think, what's happening.
You can get it all now at your leisure. Mobile as well as, you know, this to me, this is not the first time I've seen this happen. The record industry was terrified that business was going away. The movie and television industry terrified that the internet was going to, just people weren't going to go to the movies anymore. And all I ever saw was an increased appetite for content.
Yep.
We love, and content's a broad brush, but we love news, we love reading articles, we love listening to podcasts, we love watching TV shows, we watch movies, music. We're doing more of that than ever before.
And all these devices are enabling that. And I think that,
exactly.
You know, when you look at books, for example, you know, what we're here to talk today about is, you know, we saw 5 years ago that we thought the book industry was going to literally dwindle into nothingness and that no one would ever want to read books anymore. And yet today, you know, the numbers continue to grow. People still buy print books. They buy digital books. They buy audio books. And there are websites like Goodreads and so on that help enable people to share those books that they enjoy. And, you know, all these things are just going to continue to grow. They're not going to go anywhere.
That is something I find kind of interesting, that you're publishing a physical book. It's hardcover in this day and age. Are people buying books? Like books?
So 70% of all book sales, if I have this number correct, are actually physical books.
Wow.
Still in physical bookstores. And so people are buying books. I think there are certain books where they sell much more in digital format. Actually, Hatching Twitter, the numbers, you know, I hit the New York Times bestseller list and was much higher on the list for ebooks than I was for physical books, because I think the audience, you know, of course, is a very tech audience and they wanted to read it on their Kindles and iPads and so on.
Well, and I have it on Audible, I'm loving it.
The Audible version is amazing. It's read by this guy from The Walking Dead, and it's very dramatic, and it's really good.
That's kind of appropriate.
I know, right?
Especially if you're Noah Glass.
Yes.
So this is the first, you know, there's a great tradition starting, I think, going back to The Soul of a New Machine by Tracy Kidder, writing about a new mini computer from Data General, and then Stephen Levy's Hackers, and Showstoppers, G. Pascal Zachary. There have been so many great books from people kind of watching the industry from the inside, but this is the first one that has the word betrayal in the title. This is a soap opera. Hatching Twitter is Nick's new book, a true story of money, power, friendship, and betrayal. This was quite the soap opera.
Oh, it's a total soap opera. I mean, you know, when I first set out to write the book, I knew there was some drama in the story of Twitter, but I had no idea it was going to be to the extent of the drama that I found in the reporting of this book.
It must have been fun for you as it unfolded. You're going, ooh, this is getting juicy. Oh, juicier. Oh, juicier.
There were parts that I when I was doing interviews, that I literally, my mouth just dropped open, and I was like, you can't even make this stuff up. And I mean, the best way that I've described it is it's Game of Thrones, but with nerds.
And who's Ned Stark?
Who is Ned? Well, Ned Stark is killed pretty early on, so I think probably Noah.
Noah Glass is Ned Stark.
He's the guy
who came up with the that's question number one. A lot of people claim that they thought up the idea of Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go. We'll get to that, actually, because let's go to the beginning.
Okay.
And that's Ev Williams, who very famously created Blogger. He was a blogger.
Yep.
Created a platform for bloggers called Blogger that Google bought.
Yep.
And Ev made a packet of money at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I presume he worked at Google briefly, but I'm sure, you know, after his, you know, years of servitude ended, his 3 years were up, he went off on his own and started a what was his next thing? Odeo?
Well, so he worked at Blogger. Well, he started a company called Pyra Labs.
Pyra Labs, that's right. Yes.
Pyra was essentially building software. It was like B2B software. They wanted to help people organize better in the workplace. So he built that, and his girlfriend at the time, this girl Megan, went away for a couple of weeks in the summer, August of, I think, 99 maybe, or 2000 or something like that.
In the dark pre-computer era.
And Evan had worked with another employee to build this internal, what they called an internal diary system, where they could say stuff that they were reading or cool links they'd found and so on. And they decided while Megan was away that they were going to launch it to the public. And they came up with this idea to call it Blogger, which till then was a word that never had existed before. And Blogger ended up becoming this this really huge platform that people used to write and create blogs. And when Megan returned from her vacation, she was not very happy. And there was an epic fight. And eventually, most of the employees actually walked out. And it was Evan left running Blogger on his own. And right when it was about to, you know, they weren't making enough money, they were exploring trying to get new funding and so on, and then Google approached them and said, hey, we'd like to buy it, with the goal, of course, of putting advertisements next to blogs.
So in a way, this is, in a microcosm, a little of the drama that eventually came to be Twitter already with Blogger.
Yeah, it's very repetitive, the drama. So one of the things that happens in the story of Twitter is that you have friends that come together. And this is a story that happens with startups in the Valley all the time. You have friends that come together with the goal of of starting something together. And they get together and they get a few beers and they say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could do X? And the first initial version of this was, you know, Evan Williams lived on Church Street, and I think 24th or something like that in the Mission.
On the J Church line.
Yes, and he he had just sold Blogger to Google, and he hadn't moved into a bigger place yet. And across the way was this guy, Noah Glass, who literally his apartment abutted Ev's, and they became best friends. And Noah came with this idea to create a podcasting company called Odeo, and he recruited Ev to help. And just one thing after another, they started.
So Odeo was Noah's idea.
So Odeo was Noah's idea, but it also, you know, Noah was working on a pirate radio station. He wanted to build pirate radio stations that anyone could then go and create a pirate radio station on the internet. You know, all these guys really wanted to say fuck the man. And,
right.
And, you know, whether it was blogging by disrupting media, or it was a pirate radio station by disrupting, you know, radio, or the FCC or whatever, that was the driving force behind that. And they... they ended up coming together to build this thing, and it just grew rapidly. And what happened was Ev brought some of his old guys in from Blogger, including Jason Goldman and Biz Stone, and then of course they met Jack Dorsey, who came on board, and then things went horribly wrong.
So now we have the Stark family, we have the original Evan Williams, his neighbor. Noah Glass. We brought in Biz and Jack, and those are the four people who, you know, are really in the arc of Twitter. Kind of the big names that you're going to hear about, and they're going to fight.
So what happens is they have this thing called Odeo, and it's a podcasting company, and the idea is that they are going to try to disrupt radio and change the way people listen and create radio. And they have this office space, you know, down by South Park, and they have a couch, and they have podcasting equipment, and no one uses it, and no one uses the service.
I used it. We were podcasting already in 2005.
Oh, did you use Odeo?
Yeah, well, briefly. So in 2004, I did my first podcast in the fall of 2004 with everybody else. Odeo emerged a little bit later. Twit, the show, was launched in April of 2005. And we used Odeo as we used a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But of course I was very interested. I think I'd even talked to Ev a little bit, and we had mutual friends, Merlin Mann and so forth. And so I was excited to have this platform, and absolutely I used Odeo, had an Odeo account, and Twit was on Odeo.
So you used it, but the people who worked at Odeo did not use it. And they recognized that that was a problem. And so they kept trying to come up with ideas to not pivot out of Odeo, but to kind of build new things that people would actually want to use. And then what happened was, it was the morning of, I think, July 2005, and there were already problems at Odeo. There was Noah Glass and Evan Williams were fighting with each other a lot because they had disagreements over the direction of the company and so on. And what happened was they all sat down July 2005, and they sat around their computers to watch the keynote from Steve Jobs at Apple about some new iPod equipment that they were launching. And in the middle of the keynote, Jobs says that, oh, by the way, Apple is going to introduce podcasting and a distribution platform for podcasting. And in essentially that moment in time, Odeo was made non-existent.
Not alone, by the way. I was at that keynote, and of course, as a podcaster, thrilled that Apple would give us its seal of approval, but also recognized that that's a mighty big company kind of swallowing up this nascent industry. And there were others who were doing it. I'm thinking of my friend Ray Slakinski, who had a podcast, Podcatcher. And he, too, he knew his business was over. A lot of companies, but that happens. Apple does that all the time.
Oh, yeah, completely. Well, so what happened with Odeo is that they didn't know what to do. And so they started hosting these hack days, trying to figure out, you know, should they look for ways to pivot the company, you know, what other ideas were that they could take podcasting into or audio. And they were exploring literally ideas for trying to reinvent voicemail and things like that. And at the time, Noah Glass, who was essentially the heartbeat of the company, he was best friends with Jack Dorsey, and Jack Dorsey back then was you know, just a nerdy engineer. He had blue dreadlocks a few years before. He had a nose ring. He, you know, wore disheveled clothes, and he was the quietest person in the entire office. Literally spoken like monosyllables, but he got along with Noah because they had the same taste in music and drinking and partying and so on, and so. Noah was going through his company was falling apart, and he was going through divorce.
Did he think of it as his company at this point, not Ev's?
Yeah. I mean, he still believed it was his company. He believed that it was him and Ev, but he was the one that started it. You know,
right.
he you know, although although Ev had taken control of it as the CEO because Ev had funded the company, it was still very much Noah's idea. Noah was the idea guy driving a lot of it forward. Mm-hmm. But it was chaos. I mean, it was literally just chaos in the company.
You just mentioned a chaotic divorce going on for Noah as well.
So just a little side note before I get to this important moment in the story. There were these two guys that worked for Twitter. It was Rabble and Blaine, and they were both self-described anarchists.
Oh boy.
And so they used to use their programming prowess to go and help people during protests at the White House and Seattle and all these different things, and they had this mentality of essentially that same thing that these other guys had, which was off the man. And when they would have these stand-up meetings, sit-down meetings every Friday morning, Blaine and Rabble would stand up. They would refuse to sit down, and when they would sit down, they would stand up. And it was vice versa. And
was that their actual names, Blaine and Rabble?
And they were called in the company. They were called the Anarchists.
It sounds like something out of Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. The Anarchists.
So there was this mentality within Odeo that there was just chaos. So anyway, one night, Noah and Jack go out drinking and dancing and partying and drinking vodka Red Bulls, and Noah gives Jack a ride home, and it's about 2:30 in the morning, and Jack's living on 16th and Mission at the time, and they pull up onto the side of the street, and it's raining and it's cold and there's no one out, and it's very melancholic because Noah's going through a terrible divorce, and the company's failing, and Jack's upset because he wants to be a fashion designer. He doesn't want to work in programming, and he likes this girl Crystal in the office. He doesn't like him and all these things. And they have this conversation about how it feels to feel alone, and what if there was a service that you could use that would connect you to your friends? And that was the very, very first conversation about what Twitter became.
So Jack and Noah, by the way, that's a nice little point. Jack wanted to be a fashion designer. He wanted to get out of the
jeans and skirts and things like that. He did not want to be a programmer in any way, shape, or form.
By the way, you've got to have optioned this by now.
Oh yeah, it's been optioned by Lionsgate. We already started working on the TV show. Okay.
TV show.
Hmm.
Oh. Is it going to be like an HBO TV show kind of show?
Hopefully. I mean, it's going to be – I had my first meeting on Friday about it. It's going to be essentially kind of like an Orange is the New Black or
– a Netflix or a Showtime or HBO. They don't have a word for it anymore, but these Sopranos-style shows. Good. There's enough material in here for 20 hours.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. It'll be called Twitter, bitch. And I know who's going to play Noah. Oh, I didn't even know. Okay. So there used to be the story, and this is one of the interesting things I found out from the book. There's a lot of probably intentional myth-making going on about all of this.
Without a doubt.
And there was one story I remember in South Park, there's a kid's playground of Jack Dorsey on the swings and the slide. Did that never happen?
So that happened, but it's not an important part of the story. It would be like saying, literally what happened was they had these hack days, and one of the hack days, Jack had talked about this idea of being able to update your status from anywhere, but no one really paid attention to it. It didn't really go anywhere, and it wasn't until Noah came in with Jack. So Noah was very effervescent. He was, he was almost like a Kramer kind of character.
sounds like that in the book. Totally.
He's like all over the place. He's super energetic. He's really, really sweet and kind. And he's literally, just a ball of energy. He like wouldn't sleep for days at a time because he had so much energy. And he came in with Jack to talk to Evan Biz and explain this idea for the status updating thing. The day after that, they had that conversation. So in the car, the swing set had taken place, But no one had, when it came up, no one had paid attention to it because it wasn't, Jack couldn't explain it. Like it wasn't, it wasn't completely formulated.
Right.
Jack, the idea of the status update, but it was Noah's idea of connecting with friends that made it what it ended up becoming. And then what happened was they took those two concepts and then they coupled it with Biz and Ev's concepts of blogging and creating a stream of characters and this and that and the other. And essentially that was what Twitter became.
Was it 140 characters from the very first?
What's that?
140 characters from the very first.
No, it was originally unlimited. It was essentially supposed to be used by text message, but there was no limit. You could send an endless stream of text messages, but they would come as a stream of text messages.
Right.
And so in October of – so they – what happened was, just to, before we jump to that, is they created a prototype. Ev funded it. They created this prototype, and immediately it just takes off. And they – like internally, they just think this is like the greatest thing ever. And
– by the way, that's a very important sign, because Odeo, nobody was even a podcaster. They never used their own tools. Here's a tool they created that everybody uses, everybody's thrilled about. That's a good sign.
Yeah, and it's the first day that they actually use it. The first day they turn it on, you can just see the excitement. And there's a book. There's this really beautiful scene where they all sign up that morning and they're tweeting back and forth at each other. And then they go home separately and they're all going to bed and they are all say good night and going to bed and eat individually. And it's this. It's almost like a little kid's like room where you have a sleepover party. And it's actually really beautiful. And those, it's essentially what Noah dreamed it would be. It was this way to connect with your friends when they weren't there.
Yeah.
And then what happened was Noah also came up with the name Twitter. He was the one that came up with that idea.
He went, you tell the story of him going through the dictionary.
Yeah, he's flipping through the dictionary until he finds the word. But what happens is Noah starts becoming the guy who's known for Twitter. Like he's the one that's running it, essentially. And Jack Dorsey doesn't like that. And Evan and Noah are kind of fighting because they just have two differences of opinions of what this thing should be and what everything should be, essentially. And one afternoon, Jack goes into Ev's office and he says, you know, I want to talk to you confidentially. And he says, I can't work with Noah anymore. If he stays, I'm quitting. And Ev has no choice but to fire him. Noah gets pushed out of both of the companies that he helped start.
Noah doesn't have enough equity in the company to say no.
He's not a fighter. I tell stories in the book of instances before that where he was put in situations where his guardian tried to teach him how to like pick a fight and stand up for himself, and he's not wired that way. And so when it came to that, he didn't have the energy or the effort or even the know-how to stand up for himself in that regard. And one of the things that Noah said to me when I spoke to him for the book, he said, you know, I wasn't looking for like anything other than friends. And he said, the quote that he said that I thought was really beautiful was, more than fame and more than fortune, I just wanted friends.
And of course, that's the thing he lost.
And that's the thing he lost.
Because Jack immediately starts rewriting the history and taking Noah's name out.
Yeah, so Jack starts telling this story about the creation of Twitter, that Jack had come up with it years earlier on his own, and he literally from that day forth never mentions Noah's name in any kind of interview or anything, and Noah's just literally ejected from the company. He gets no equity in Twitter, Jack ends up getting 20% of the company, which today has made him into a multi-billionaire.
Book about Facebook, The Accidental Billionaires, was written. The informant, the source, was Eduardo Saverin, who was similarly written out very early of Facebook's history, who got a little money but didn't make anywhere near that amount of money. Is Noah the source? Is he the guy behind this book?
Everyone is the source behind this book. As I write in the very beginning, I spoke to probably 300-400 people for this book. I spent 65 hours with every single founder alone, the board members. I got access to thousands of documents, internal documents, legal documents, calendars, emails, and then actually one of the greatest tools for reporting and ensuring that people were being honest with me was Twitter.
That's ironic.
I went through and exhaustively searched for their tweets and their Flickr photos and their Facebook updates from those days that incidents took place. So essentially the way I reported the book is I got access to the documents first, right? So I know exactly when things happened based on the dates of the documents. Then I went to the people and I did interviews based on those, and I got their viewpoints and their opinions. And of course, certain things didn't line up because everyone's trying to protect themselves. And then I would go and I would check social media and Twitter, and I would see that, you know, the night that this is a perfect example, the night that Noah was fired, Noah had no idea that Jack was involved in his firing, and still didn't know until he read my book. And
you're kidding.
The night that Noah was fired, Jack had tweeted that he was going out for, or Noah had tweeted that he had gone out dancing with Jack and drinking. And so I asked him, I went back to Noah and I said, hey, did Jack ever mention anything about you being, you know, about him, his involvement with, you know, you being pushed out? And he goes, no, he said it was Ev, and, you know, Ev had and everything to do with it. But I also had emails with Jack's name on involved in the firing of Noah. So, you know, it was really, really fascinating to see how they all helped ensure that the story that was in the book was accurate. And they all spoke to me for the book.
How did you have access to these early tweets?
So I used to program called I forget the name of it, but it, an early Twitter employee has it, and it's I don't know if it's still available, but this guy Kellen, he was a very early Twitter employee. He built an API where you could search the first year of Twitter, and so I search for the first time someone had written earthquake or so on. But then I actually hired a researcher to go and just copy and paste every single tweet from all of the early people that worked there, and we put it into a database, and then I could go through and search based on date and so on.
Do you feel like this is really great because it's all documented. It's you got it all in writing. You can say, hey, no, I see what happened because you tweeted it. Do you feel like Ev and others regretted talking to you about this?
No, I think that, you know, I mean, I think one person who may have regretted it, maybe, and I haven't spoken to him about it, is Jack.
He comes off worst in this, I think.
Jack comes off, you know, really bad because he has deceived people, and he has written people out of history. And he, you know, somebody, a bunch of people have tweeted in the past, you know, that have read the book, oh, Nick Bilton really doesn't like Jack Dorsey. And that's not true in the slightest. The people I interviewed don't like Jack Dorsey. And, you know, I have no qualms in who people like and who they don't. Like, I have to tell a story that I report and I write in a book, and that is what this became. And you know, time and time again, I would go to people and I would ask them something, and they would be like, you know, I'm really pissed that Jack didn't include me in this, or that Jack lied about this, or that Jack said that, but even this happened. And you know, all of those stories kind of add up. And you can see in the later part of the book, when Jack starts being compared to Steve Jobs, he's actually quoting you know, Steve Jobs quotes without giving them attribution. And the whole thing, it's one kind of mythical narrative from beginning to end. Yeah. And the thing that's crazy about it is it doesn't have to be. Like, he was involved in creating something that was amazing, and he had a really important role in that, and he just wanted to take other people's credit too, which I you know, I don't know. I think people found very, very disheartening.
Not to tip off the end of the book, but Noah Glass, while he doesn't make much money off of Twitter, it's kind of a happy ending. He's all right.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think, you know, if you have a heart and these things called morals, you will read the book and you will feel, you know, that Noah ended up in a good place. He didn't end up in a good place financially. Necessarily, but he ended up, you know, he learned a lot of lessons, and he found the things that he was searching for. And I think you kind of, you know, the impression that I get rereading it and writing it is that, you know, certain people that made a tremendous amount of money did so at the behest of their friendships. And I think that they are not necessarily in as good of a place as Noah is.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. That might be one of the morals of this book is unfettered ambition does not necessarily give you happiness.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that, you know, you're continually to search for more attention and more whatever it is. It's not the money. These guys are, you know, they're by the money. The money is just it's almost like a video game where that's the high score.
Unless you get no money, like Noah.
Unless you get no money. But, you know, it's interesting. So Florian, here's an example. Florian is one of the very early programmers, and he left because of some issues that came up, and he got no money. Mm-hmm. And you talked to him on the phone. I've spoken to him for the book, and he's like, look, he goes, you know, I was involved in creating something that changed the world. And he's like, and sure, I got no money, but that's fine. It's, you know, it doesn't bother me. I think that for all of them, what really was more important to them was being given credit for being involved in this thing. Yeah. And that was the thing that drove them all.
And Twitter did change the world. We're going to talk a little bit about that in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Personal Capital. See, now this is how this happens here. We had the founder of Personal Capital on Triangulation. I was interviewing him, former CEO of PayPal and of Intuit. And we were talking about money. We were talking about finance. And he said, I'm starting off this new thing called Personal Capital. And so I said, okay, well, that sounds interesting. Let me check it out. And I've been a customer ever since. It's great. I don't know if you can call yourself a customer of something that doesn't cost you anything. I guess you can. So be on the show, and your next thing will be huge, and you'll be buying advertisements on the show later. Maybe that's how it works. I don't know. Let me tell you a little bit about Personal Capital. If you visit personalcapital.com, you can see how it works. It essentially gives you a dashboard for your financial life. You know, whether you're Ev Williams or Noah Glass, you've got a financial life, and as you go along in life, it all gets harder to keep track of. Not just your paycheck, but then you get investments, you get your retirements, your IRAs, your bank accounts, your loans, and it gets just complicated. It's hard to keep track of, and then, of course, the other problem is you've got to pay somebody to manage it, and you're probably paying too much. A lot of us geeks like to do it ourselves. Personal Capital gives you the tools you need to know how you're doing. You can see your net worth, how your assets are performing on one screen on your computer, your phone, your tablet. Beautiful color-coded graphs make it very straightforward. Shows you how much, for instance, you're paying in money managers and fees, how to reduce those fees. You can also get specific advice on how to improve your investment strategy, and it's all free. Personal Capital. They've been featured all over the net. Bloomberg, Time, Forbes. And you can try it free yourself. Go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. Once you've got it set up, you'll see how easy it is to use and how much you learn just from the basic stuff of it. Really a cool idea. personalcapital.com/triangulation. Try it today. We thank them for the support of Triangulation. I joined Twitter pretty early on, December 2006. So it was, what, about 6 months old?
Mm-hmm.
Then? Yep. And I, you know, I didn't get it. I didn't tweet a lot. A lot of people didn't get it. It was TWTTR, I think, still. And I wasn't a big text message user. In fact, texting even was in its infancy in the United States. It was big all over the world, but in the U.S., because we had different carriers and stuff, it was slow to catch on.
What was your username when you first joined?
Well, this is the thing. It was Leo Laporte, and then I quit because I was worried about you won't find that first account because I was worried about copyright confusion, frankly. And I even spoke to Ev on one of our shows around about that time. And he said, yeah, we knew about Twit. We didn't think Twitter or Twit was going to become big, so we didn't worry about it so much. Noah would have known because of Odeo and Twit's involvement with podcasting.
Well, I found your first tweet.
When was it?
It says, I surrender Twitter, you win.
That's me coming back. So that's April 2007. So Justine, I think we were – well, okay, so Twitter had its big – debut, at least in the public eye, at that year's South by Southwest.
Correct. That's in the book.
That was huge, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but I guess because it's it's 10,000, 20,000 geeks all in Austin, Texas.
I'll tell you why.
Why?
So what happened was at South by Southwest, you were at a point in time. It was right before the iPhone was going to come out. Yeah. The iPhone would be announced later that year, right? And yeah. And you had people that had these weird phones. They had, you know, Trios and things. Remember those black and white screens with like six colors?
I, I had a visor. Yes.
So of course the nerds had these phones, right. But they didn't have anything to do with them, right? They could send emails, and they could maybe use an app where they could sync their, three articles from Yahoo News or whatever it was. But that was it. And so when Twitter came along, it was a way to talk to other people and be engaged with other people using text messaging, where it was essentially text messaging was an app that would work across any mobile device. And so you had people that were at South By that were having essentially back channel conversations and hearing about things that were going on all through Twitter. And it was right time, right place, right technology for that moment in time.
You couldn't have found a better place to debut and more influential people to debut with. Now, I have to point out that, I left Twitter and went to a service called Jaiku, which has since died.
Yep.
But Jaiku predated Twitter. I don't think Twitter knew about Jaiku or vice versa, but the time was ripe for something like this.
Biz Stone told me that in hindsight, one of the things that that happened with Twitter was down all the time. It was the service
fail whale.
Jack Dorsey and Noah Glass and Florian Weber, when they first built the first version of this thing, they built it as a prototype to test it out. And at that point, they never switched it over to be actually a real website. It just continued to grow. And the site, it was built poorly. It was built really, really terribly. It was stuck together with duct tape and super glue. And I think I have a line in the book where I say, it was built as a dinghy to kind of test things out. And now it was being used as an ocean liner to ship people across the ocean. And the reality was it couldn't handle that. And so the site kept going down all the time. But as a result, what Biz said to me is, as a result, the website... people said, well, if this thing keeps going down and people are complaining about it and the blogosphere is, writing about it all the time, saying this thing's always down, I need to see what it is. And so therefore people would...
It's good for it. Yeah.
People rush off and try to check it out.
It was, I think it was the spring. It was April of 2007 that Justine said, you've got to get back on Twitter because this is going to be exploding. And I had the most followers on Twitter. And this will tell you how early it was. 5,000.
Wow, that's huge.
and then Kevin Rose and I were in a race to the top. Then along comes Barack Obama, not before Justin Bieber, was Ashton Kutcher. I think Ashton was the first celebrity to really glom onto this. And the numbers got hugely inflated, and of course I'm left in the dust long ago. But Twitter, and it's interesting because there are very different stages in Twitter, and it's the experience of Twitter. As you mentioned, the very earliest days, it was friends talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's far from that today.
Well, I think that, one of the things that I found really, really fascinating in the book is there's a moment in at South by Southwest that year in 2007. And, they had an idea that people would use this thing, but they had no idea that they would use it in the way that they did. And there was one evening where, they would be out and they would be drinking on many evenings, sorry. And they would be at a bar and all of a sudden people's phones would start, making ding noises and vibrating and so on. And everyone would be paring down at their phones. You got to remember, this is not a time when there were smartphones. And so they'd be peering down at their phones and then all of a sudden everyone would like rush out of the bar. Ev and Goldman and those guys would be like, where the heck is everyone going? And someone would respond, oh, people are tweeting about another party down the street.
Wow.
And people at the bloggers at South By that year started calling it flocking, where you would essentially like birds flocking. You would have that happen. So 2 years later, literally 2 years later in 2009, Jack had been fired from the company at this point, and Ev was running it, and Biz Stone and Jason Goldman were kind of running the communications aspect of it. And so 2 years later, there were the Iranian revolutions, and you had people using Twitter in the exact same way that they had been using it at South By, but they were using it to organize protests. And so 2 years early, you had a bunch of nerdy geeks using it to find a free beer. And 2 years you had it used to overthrow a government.
It wasn't long before you saw the hashtag on every TV show, on every news show. You saw the at sign everywhere. But neither the hashtag nor the at reply were invented by Twitter. I guess that's, in a way, that's another sign of success, that its users created a lot of the ways Twitter ended up getting used.
Well, yeah. So I think that, you know, what happened was you had this experience where you the company was growing so quickly and there was so much chaos in the company. So this is, you know, after Noah left, Jack had taken over, but he didn't know what he was doing. He had never run a company before. He'd never even had an employee before. So he was, and he was dealing with the anarchists and all these other people, and it was just chaos. And so there was the fighting between Ev and Jack over who would run the company and who was doing the right job and whatever. And while this was going on and they were trying to keep the website up and running, what happened was the users said, you know what, we're going to take this into our own hands and create essentially products within Twitter that we want to use. And the first thing that they created was the at symbol, where people would reply to each other with an at symbol.
That so wasn't part of Twitter. That was people just doing it.
There was people that was just doing it. And then later along came Chris Messina, who started the hashtag. And he said, you know, we should really come up with a way for people to tag events, so we know what to search for, because there were third party apps like Surmise and so on that allowed search. And in doing so, they created the hashtag, and the hashtag is now, you know, the one thing that connects Twitter to the outside world. And then the third thing people created was actually sharing links. People started pasting links into the thing and into the 140 character box. You asked earlier, actually.
Yeah, we didn't get that.
Was it 140 characters?
Yeah.
So it was unlimited at first, and then in October of 2006, it was taken to 160 character limitation. And then it wasn't until the following year around South By that it went to 140 characters, and they took off those 20 characters so that you could include someone's username in there.
And that's the story. It was pretty clear that the success of Twitter was also due to the simplicity of Twitter. It wasn't hard to figure out.
Well, it wasn't. So I've said before that, you know, with Facebook, you sign up to Facebook and it's super simple to use, and you use it obsessively, and then you get Facebook fatigue because you're kind of sick of it and you're over it. When you sign up for Twitter, even though it was super simple, it was really kind of difficult for mainstream people to understand, and you sign up with Twitter fatigue. You originally start with it, but then once you start to figure it out, you start to use it obsessively.
It's upside down. You start with fatigue, and then you start to figure it out. You understand that, oh, I can follow anybody I want. That was unique. I think that was also brilliant, and it wasn't the most obvious thing was you – craft your own Twitter feed. It's unique to you based on who you follow.
Yep. And that was actually created from Odeo. Odeo had this they called this the friendship model at Odeo, where they wanted to be able to create things where you could see what podcast people were listening to, or follow a friend and share a podcast with them. And it was, you know, there were all these different concepts, and the 140 character status update aspect of that then kind of moved over to this idea in Twitter.
Such an interesting story, both inside, internally, and I think we didn't really know how crazy it was internally.
Oh, yeah, no one knew.
But also how the world used Twitter in unexpected ways, and how important it became to our culture, so much so that the Library of Congress got the entire Twitter archive, every tweet. And I presume it's still getting it. I don't know.
It's fascinating because you have when you look at it now – imagine if we didn't have it, you know, imagine how would you share a story that you read or you wrote? How would, you know, the Pope talk to people? How would, I mean, of course there are other alternative ways, but we don't tune into television to see what Barack Obama has to say, you know, in the way that we did in the past. We don't, you know, you don't look for business stories by just going to the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times business section. Like you rely on Twitter to surface these things. And I think that for me, one of the most fascinating aspects is the fact that Twitter allows you to see things and be places that you would never actually be able to go in life. And so some of my favorite accounts to follow are actually the astronauts in space.
Yep.
And because
Chris Hadfield had an amazing – I mean, it was amazing to watch him on Twitter.
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was like I literally would wake up in the morning and check Chris Hadfield's account to see what pictures he'd sent in the middle of the night. And I think that is that's really something that that Twitter affords that we never really had the opportunity to do before.
But that does say something, because I don't know if this is your experience, and of course everybody's experience of Twitter is different because of who you follow, but you had to go check Chris Hadfield's account. You couldn't just look at your stream and see it because there's so much crap in your stream.
That's the problem, and that's what they're trying to do now. I mean, the Discover tab and all these other things are you know, attempts at trying to find the best things and distill them for you. But, you know, the reality is right now, humans don't trust computers enough to be able to say, oh, the computer is going to solve right. this problem and find you everything you need.
Well, they look at Facebook. They're trying to do that, and it's horrible.
Everyone's trying to do it, but you don't. Yeah. You go and you check people's feeds because right. you're like, I don't believe that the computer figured out what I needed.
I have to check it for myself. It's been instrumental in everything from nowadays. If I hear somebody's died, the first thing I do is go to Twitter to see, because it will blow up.
Oh, completely. Anything. I mean, there was I was driving home the other night, and I saw cops all over my neighborhood. I mean, like 50 cop cars and helicopters, and I wasn't going to go to the San Francisco Chronicle to find out what happened.
No, of course
it's
not
happening. So I went to Twitter and I searched my neighborhood and police and found out that there was somebody had been shot and then they were chasing the guy and he was down this alley and people were like, he's just in my backyard. And it's literally real time, you know, news that's happening. And we're all essentially a part of sharing and creating it.
And on the day that Osama bin Laden was killed, we got to follow that story from a guy who was sitting there and said, well, there's a bunch of helicopters. Wow, I hear explosions. We got to follow that as it happened on Twitter. Actually, in retrospect, because nobody really knew what was going on. But we looked and, look, he's tweeting about it.
This guy's live tweeting it.
Wow. And I have to bring up Jenna Wortham's column yesterday on the New York Times. And I think Jenna is not far off. She says that the problem with Twitter is now we understand suddenly the currency of Twitter is getting retweeted, is getting promoted by other people, and we've all become stand-up comedians actively, aggressively, annoyingly trying to get that retweet. And it's turned Twitter into just a bunch of loudmouth, obnoxious Jerry Lewis's. She's got a point.
No, totally. I mean, during the Gmail outage this week, I was sitting on a plane waiting to take off, and I was checking Twitter, and it was, you know, Gmail went down for like 14 minutes and my feed was just tens of thousands of wannabe jokes. And some of them were funny and most of them were not, but it was everyone just trying to outdo each other. And the other thing that's happened too is, do you remember the Justine Sacco event when the woman tweeted about going to Africa and the AIDS joke?
Yes. Terrible. Horrible.
Wrote a piece about for that, and it was, you know,
cost her job, rightly so.
Cost her job, but at the same time, I wrote a piece for the Times about the Twitter mob and how unruly the mob can be on the internet. And one of the things I noted is, you know, is that we this real time event system that we have called Twitter allows people to be emotional and share what they're saying on a massive scale, but they do it without the realization that there is another human being on the end. And while Justine Sacco was wrong for what she said and what she did, there were people that threatened her family on Twitter and threatened to rape and kill her and so on. And I don't think that one wrong should be okay when in those instances.
Yeah, she's maybe not the best example because she said something pretty reprehensible. But there are hundreds and hundreds, thousands of examples of Twitter becoming a mob mentality. But that's the internet, isn't it? I mean, the internet fosters that kind of anonymous drive-by, slander.
Yeah, it completely. And then real time makes it quicker and more accurate as far as people's viewpoints and opinions. And the thing that I've learned as a reporter for the Times, especially, where an editor will check things and vet them, and another editor will check those and vet those before anything goes out, is that, you know, you have to strip that emotion out, and it takes a few minutes to really sit there and think about things, or a few hours in some instances, before you can actually have a conversation about something without the emotion being the driving, fueling force.
And this doesn't feel like this is something Twitter has a lot of control over. Who's running Twitter these days? It's Dick Costolo, right?
Dick Costolo is running Twitter. You know, Ev and Jack are still on the board. They have no involvement whatsoever. Either of them have any involvement in the day-to-day operations of the company. That's essentially Dick that's running it. And then there's over 2,000 employees that are, you know, it's a lot of salespeople that are doing advertising-related projects. There are people that are experimenting with new apps and interfaces and so on, and then, you know, there's a lot of support staff and engineers and so on, and that's essentially the how it's run today.
Do they have a sense that there can any way their knob turning makes any difference to how Twitter is? I mean, now of course Twitter went public a few months ago. Their stock price has actually done very well, so there's a lot of people who are reaping the benefits of Twitter, but that doesn't mean that Twitter is particularly profitable or will ever be profitable. That's unknown. And it's not clear what Twitter's future holds. It's changed every month. It's a different thing.
Well, I think that's, you know, I mean, to bring it back to the beginning, I think, you know, one of the things when Twitter first became public, when it became not public as a company, but when it launched to the public in early 2006, and Noah Glass wrote the very first blog post about Twitter, and he explained that it was the service that you could make you feel less alone and connect you with your friends. And then he said at the very end of this post, you know, if that's not what you want Twitter to be, essentially what Twitter is whatever you want it to be.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, he had it right from day one, and today that's still the case. And anytime that Twitter says, "Oh, it's a network for talking to people. It's a way to share news. It's a way for you to watch television and tweet about the show you're doing," it doesn't matter what they say, because people are going to use it how they want to use it, and it's essentially whatever they want it to be.
Makes it very hard to talk about, because
it makes it easy to you know, it's a blank piece of paper. It's like saying that a blank piece of paper can only be used for words, or it can only be used for drawing, or to make music, whatever. It is a blank piece of paper, and you get to do whatever you want on it.
So what is Twitter's future? Will they, I mean, the stock market thinks they'll be profitable. Obviously they started at around $40. They're now up to 60.
They've been controlling that. I mean, they could have been profitable a year ago. They've intentionally controlled that, so that they can use that as a way to spike the stock if they need to push it up. And I'm sure that it will either hear that they're profitable during this earnings call, which is next week, or we'll hear it during the next one, or the one after that. But the company's making a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars a year in advertising.
And that's with the sponsored tweets and things like that?
Sponsored tweets, sponsored Twitter users, sponsored posts, sponsored everything. They have APIs that people build into, that advertising APIs, you know, lots of different things like that.
You know, and one of the ways they've done this, and it has irritated some, but it seems to have been a good business move, is to get rid of third-party clients and say, if you want to have a Twitter experience, you either go to Twitter.com or you use our client, where we're going to send you those sponsored tweets and so forth.
Yeah, so what's happened, I think, is you know, they realized that if they wanted to control the experience and make it a fluid, cohesive experience, they had to get rid of the clients. And the clients still exist for the you know,
outlets. Oh yeah, I use a client, but
99% of, I think it's more than 99% of users on Twitter use Twitter's apps and website and so on. And the reason for that, because it's twofold, actually. One of the reasons is because they want to ensure that the site, the experience is cohesive across all your devices, and that you know how to use Twitter on your smartphone, on your iPad, on your computer. But the other reason is with the APIs, they were setting themselves up where people could build apps and then kind of take the users away from Twitter into these new ecosystems, and it could really hurt Twitter. And so they were essentially building roads to the city of Twitter, but other people would have been able to kind of build roads off those roads to other cities, if you will, and take all those people away.
So while a lot of third-party developers have been pissed, and some of us have been annoyed, early users have been annoyed, because we say, well, you got to dance with the one that brung you. That's what made Twitter so successful, was your API. It hasn't hurt. Sounds like it hasn't hurt Twitter. People who use Twitter today don't care. I'm annoyed by the fact that I see ads in the middle of my Twitter feed, like this ad for a cruise line. But nevertheless, this is, you know, and, you know, this
at least
is,
it's a pretty picture with the ad.
It's a pretty picture. That's something new, too. They added inline media of all kinds to make the Twitter feed more adorable. But that's an ad. I mean, yeah. I'm seeing a lot of ads in my Twitter feed. Sponsored, promoted accounts, sponsored tweets. That hasn't stopped its growth? That hasn't annoyed people?
No, it's. I mean, I think that, you know, the goal is that you get those tweets are supposed to actually be relevant to what it is that you are you're interested in. And I think that, you know, they're going to continue to try to strive towards that, and advertisers want that. If you know, one of the great things that you can do with the Twitter ad experience is that you can take a tweet. So I could take my book, and I could write a tweet and say, "Hey, check out Hatching Twitter at hatchingtwitter.com if you want to buy it." Right, and so. I can take that tweet, I can go and promote it, and I can say, only show this to people who live in Silicon Valley who have tweeted about something tech-related in the past 6 months.
So it's like Facebook, but even better, really.
Yeah, and that's the eventual goal with it.
Yeah. So they've got a good monetization plan in place. They can their stock price is strong, and they can control that by becoming profitable in any given quarter. It doesn't feel like they have a lot of control about who uses Twitter or what it becomes, but they don't seem to be too worried about that as long as it continues to grow. And there's no question, you don't launch a TV show without a hashtag. You don't. Tomorrow, the State of the Union address, I'm sure there'll be literally millions of tweets, probably per second, about that.
You know, the great thing about that is I don't have to worry about being home to watch the State of the Union address. I can just follow it on Twitter, and people will tweet the most interesting parts.
Is that the same? Come on, Nick. Really? That's as good as watching it?
In some respects, when you don't have that option to be where it is that in front of a TV. I didn't watch the Grammys. I don't care about the Grammys, but I saw the few things that I thought were interesting from the people that shared them. Maybe it is.
It is how we consume the world these days, and I think you made an excellent point. Early on, which is it's how you can be places that you would not be otherwise. It really extends your sensorium to the whole world. And as Twitter becomes more of a global thing, and it is global. Is the U.S. even the biggest part of Twitter now? I don't know
what the numbers are as far as global reach, but I don't think so. I would imagine not. Yeah, I mean, huge in Asia. The numbers are just massive.
Yeah.
Brazil's huge. It's continuing to grow globally, and I think will continue to grow for quite some time.
It's a business story. It's a story of San Francisco go-go entrepreneurial business. It's also a whodunit.
It is. It's written like a murder mystery.
It's a murder mystery. Hatching Twitter. Who killed Noah Glass? A true story of money, power, friendship, and betrayal. Yes, it was a bestseller. That must have made you feel pretty good at the New York Times.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Wall Street Journal, too. Economist Best Book of 2013. Wall Street Journal Best Book of the Year, Reader's Choice. Amazon Best Book of the Month. And Leo Laporte says, if you're on Twitter, you've got to read Hatching Twitter. HatchingTwitter.com. You can get a copy in a variety of forms, including hardcover, but also... The Audible book, which is really well done. And you even have a hashtag, Hatching Twitter. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Nick Bilton from the New York Times. What are you working on these days? What's the big story you're following?
What are we working on? I just did a post today on Snapchat, and people keep asking me why people use it, and I explained why people use it. Essentially, it's ugly and ephemeral, which is important. I wrote a column this weekend about the holodeck. And how that's going to be coming soon, and then I'm going to be working on some stories this week on some of the privacy stuff and net neutrality and things like that.
You have a great gig, and they got a good guy in you because Nick started as a technologist, and so you bring this deep knowledge of technology and the business, and that's what they need. But you're also a great writer and a very good reporter, and so they're really. I hope the Times appreciates you. They're getting a great guy.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm going to come up and do Twit again soon.
Well, yeah, I count on it.
All right.
All right. Nick Bilton, thank you so much. Again, the book Hatching Twitter, available everywhere and a must read. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Our show is every Monday now. I hope you tune in 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 2100 UTC on twit.tv. But, of course, I say that because I like seeing you live. I like watching the chat room questions and so forth. But I got to tell you, you can always watch after the fact. We've got on-demand audio and video available, so you can listen at your convenience. twit.tv/TRI. It's also on YouTube, youtube.com/triangulation. And you can subscribe. If Odeo are still around, you can subscribe there. But iTunes, I guess, will have to do, and the Xbox music and all of that. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation.